This is Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Now, Connected to Chicago.
And welcome to Connected to Chicago. This week, the governor decided to set a date to rescind his mask mandate in most settings across the state. That would happen by the end of the month if the COVID metrics continue a downward trend. But there's still some legal questions. Before we welcome in our guest, let's go back and revisit part of the governor's announcement last week.
Last August, in the face of a growing threat from the Delta variant, most Illinoisans put their masks back on in response. And as a result, we ended 2021 with fewer COVID-19 hospitalizations per capita than anywhere else in the Midwest. More Illinoisans have gotten a COVID-19 shot than anywhere else in the Midwest. More of our kids are fully vaccinated than anywhere in the region. Nearly 80% of our eligible seniors are boosted. Vaccines work. Masks work. Throughout this pandemic, we've deployed the tools available to us as needed. We've used masks more when infections are raging and hospitals are stretched thin. We've used masks less when spread is diminished and hospitals have enough bandwidth. Our approach has saved lives and kept our economy open and growing. Today, 3 weeks past the peak, and thanks to the precautions our residents have taken, from Chicago to Carbondale, the heightened emergency of Omicron has been consistently subsiding. We are now seeing the fastest rate of decline in our COVID-19 hospitalization metrics since the pandemic began. Our daily total of COVID patients in the hospital has fallen from over 7,300 to about 2,500 today, a 66% drop. The daily total of COVID patients requiring ICU care has also seen a 63% drop. We now have 20% of our ICU beds available statewide, up from a low of just under 8% only 4 weeks ago. Vaccines work. Masks work. And as a result of them and the tremendous commitment of our state's residents, we are on track to come out on the other side of this latest COVID storm in better shape than even the doctors expected. If these trends continue, and we expect them to, then on Monday, February 28th, we will lift the indoor mask requirement for the state of Illinois. I want to be clear, many local jurisdictions, many businesses and organizations have their own mask requirements and other mitigations that must be respected. Doing what's right in your private business or for your local communities is encouraged. Whether you're a business, a township, a venue, a place of worship, or a city, to name just a few examples, protecting your patrons and visitors is no doubt a high priority. Masks continue to be a very effective way to keep your establishment from experiencing an outbreak or spreading the disease. Remember that whether we remove masks or not, COVID-19 has not gone away. There are so many Illinoisans who need to protect themselves from the virus more than others. And many more of us who gladly put on our masks, not so much for ourselves, but for our elderly neighbor, for our immunocompromised aunt, for the toddlers for whom there is not yet a vaccine, for adults who are medically unable to be vaccinated, for the person in the room whose circumstance they do not know.
And we welcome into the program Margaret Etienne, a professor of law at the University of Illinois. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think the first thing that some folks still don't have a lot of clarity on is when the governor expanded the initial emergency mandate that he passed down. Some lawmakers kind of thinking that that was never legal to extend his emergency orders the first time. Can you take us back in time, if you will, and was there some legal questions about whether or not the governor had the authority to do that?
So, you know, as you know, Nick, I mean, there have been emergency orders upon emergency orders from the beginning of this. We've been doing this now for almost 3 years, I think. And so there have been a series of them. But I think the ones that people are, at least the ones that are involved in this most recent lawsuit, are the ones stemming from this fall. So there were emergency orders. Well, we know that in June, there was a sort of alleviation of some of the orders in terms of wearing masks in public. And then we kind of went back to an executive order in August and another one in September. So some of the orders deal with just wearing masks in public, and then some of them are specific to the reopening of schools and what was going to be required to reopen schools. So the two that people seem to be the most concerned about was the school-related one is what we're hearing a lot about, and that was the August 2021 executive order that Governor Pritzker signed. And it essentially said, you know, we're going to reopen schools because, you know, last year a lot of schools weren't open. But we're going to do it under the conditions that students wear masks, teachers wear masks, that there's vaccination requirements, and that there's some testing requirements, right? So that was that order. And a lot of people didn't like that, didn't like the fact that there was a mandate at all, that it was required. But then, you know, there have also been a series of other orders either expanding or limiting that, changing that as the times have changed, right, as far as what we know about how COVID-19 is progressing, and particularly with this Omicron right. Later in the fall. So that's kind of the background on, you know, the bunch of orders. People are really concerned about the ones relating to schools, and of course people are concerned about the ones that just deal with, you know, being indoors in public spaces.
You know, and some people are saying that, the separate mandate, I guess, for school safety and masks in schools, at least when you look at Chicago, for instance, the mayor is saying because they're a union shop, the collective bargaining agreement is in place. And I realize that Chicago is a home rule city and they can probably do whatever they want. But let's pretend for a moment they weren't. Is that true that, you know, you have the union there and they have a certain agreement, I guess it would be with the city, that then says, you know, well, part of what we've worked out is we do have masks in school and we can ignore the governor. I mean, does that have legal grounds?
There are legal grounds, but those are contractual rules and union rules, right? So, you know, now imagine if we were in a different state and the governor said, as we've seen in other states, right, no masks, or masks are forbidden, mm-hmm. or masks are, you know, school by school or district by district, sort of local rules, or as we have here, you know, a mandate for masks. All of these places have unions. All of these places have schools and teachers. And so you do end up having a kind of umbrella rule that the governor or the state legislature can impose, and then these regulations that are essentially almost by agreement with the school districts and the unions and the teachers themselves. But what has gotten parents and students upset is feeling like they don't have a voice about that, right, about what gets decided by the district and the unions and the teachers, and that parents and students are kind of part of that decision. And I think that's part of what has gotten a lot of people, you know, concerned.
Right. Well, so and then you mentioned lawmakers and people feel that they're not being represented. And that's kind of the argument that we're hearing downstate with some of the state reps and state senators that are against basically the governor's mandates. They're saying, well, the governor has gone out and you know, he put these mandates into place without consulting or taking a vote on it through the legislature. Therefore, the people that we represent don't have a say-so in this. Now, some, I've heard the argument saying that when it comes to public health and safety, there has always been precedent out there in the legal world that any court would side with the governor or side with the state or side with, you know, the executive branch, let's say.
Sure.
Is that kind of the case? Is that how really things play out in the real world?
Yeah, in a word. So here's the deal with that. I think that part of what we're seeing is, to repeat what you said, in a sense, when there's an emergency, when there is a public health crisis, we want the executive, we want the governor, we want the heads of public health to be able to promulgate rules to keep everybody safe. And that's where we were, right? I think most people would agree, at least a couple years ago. And what we're seeing now, what we're hearing now, is some of the legislators, you know, central Illinois and downstate for sure, are saying, well, we're not really in an emergency anymore. You know, now there's been plenty of time. And so this lawsuit, where we got the ruling earlier in the week, mm-hmm. is essentially basically saying, you know, it's one thing to say there's an emergency. Now we've had a couple of years. If the legislature, if the governor wanted a new rule, then it needs to go through the legislature. We're no longer in emergency executive order territory, and we should not be required to follow those rules. Now, that's a matter of disagreement, right? But that's essentially the issue that's being argued is, you know, this is not an emergency where we get the governor gets to say we all have to do this. Sure, there's a time for that, and maybe that was the case a couple of years ago. But now a lot of people are thinking that's not the case. Now, on the other side, there are a lot of people who think, you know, the coronavirus, COVID, is still causing a lot of damage. The numbers are still quite high. This is still an emergency, and we should have the ability, the governor should have the ability to have an executive order or an emergency order that keeps us all safe. And I'd add that particularly with schools, that particularly with kids, that there should be that ability. But that's the debate right there.
Well, and I'm hearing from people, too, that, you know, so the governor has directed the attorney general then to appeal this ruling that we saw in the downstate court. And some folks are saying it's likely that the mandate, although we have an end date now, at least, but mm-hmm. if they let this play out in court, that the mandate would stand, that another court would overrule that downstate court, because going back to that argument that it was created under this guise of this is an emergency, a health issue. But having listened to what you just said, could we see a judge say, yeah, well, you know what, it's really not that big of an emergency anymore, so we're going to let that lower court's ruling stand? How do you see it being played out if this does continue to move forward?
Well, as a legal matter, my best judgment, my best guess would be that if the Attorney General, Raul, you know, and apparently he is seeking an expedited appeal, that they would succeed in that the mandate would stand. I think that's the most likely precedent that we would see. You know, and again, I think we have to differentiate between, you know, because, yeah, there's the emergency question, but there's also the precedent that, you know, there are, you know, students are required to have immunization and vaccinations for all sorts of other things. Like, there's plenty of precedent to require some kind of health-based regulations in the schools. So I think that just purely on a legal matter, the governor probably has the better argument on this one.
The upper hand on it, yeah. Let me jog your memory back again, if I can, for a minute. Darren Bailey had filed a lawsuit. Basically, the judge, I believe, if I remember this correctly, declared that some of the mandates, or one of the mandates, was unconstitutional. Whatever happened to that?
Oh, that's a really good question. I do recall that. And I think that in part when, and that's related to the fact that we do have an end date now. I don't think that the governor, I don't think that they pushed back on that. You know, I think that there was some success on that argument, and then there was a different executive order that, you know, made that earlier question moot. And I'm trying to remember the details of it now, but that's my recollection, is that they didn't really try to continue to appeal that on a legal basis. Just as a policy matter, they said, okay, well, let's let that fall. And then there was another executive order that sort of changed things around. And that's what a lot of people are asking now, is now that we have an end date, or close to an end date, what sounds like it'll be, you know, the end of this month, will these lawsuits, you know, be just moot and kind of go away? Or will, you know, will the courts continue to hear them? Or will we just say, well, you know, now the question has already been decided, and we don't need them decided by the courts.
You know, so I guess that brings up the next question then. And that is, if there is another variant, I mean, there's these sub-variants out there, right, that we know about.
Yeah, that's right.
And unfortunately, you know, just kind of like with Omicron and with Delta, you see that, you know, it ebbs and flows, it comes up to a peak and comes back down again. How likely is it, if things get bad again, is the governor going to be easily able to impose another mask mandate, or is it going to be a lot harder for him this time? Because basically, it would be, what, the third time that he would have to kind of shut things down and declare an emergency. I mean, do you see it as real easy thing for him to do, or is he going to get even more pushback, or should he maybe go through the legislature this time?
Well, that's a really good question, Nick. And I think part of that is a legal question, and some of it is a sort of policy politics question. Mm-hmm. I think that on the legal side, he can, you know, if things get bad, another variant, another virus, another public health issue, you know, the law is still pretty clear that the governor has the power, the ability to issue these executive orders, these mandates for public safety. So I don't think anything we've seen has made that go away. But I think that the premise of your question is right. There's no indication that this will be over forever, right? That there may be another variant, another public health crisis, something else. So I think that you know, on a policy level, Governor Pritzker and others will probably continue to try to consult with lots of different people, you know, to see what's going to happen. Now, one thing that we saw earlier on, which we haven't seen as much in the conversations lately, is this idea that there should be some sort of local rule that counties or school districts for themselves can decide. I could imagine seeing things move in that direction, because that's really what this recent lawsuit has done, right, is by, you know, issuing this temporary restraining order on the mandate. What you've started to see is a lot of different school districts coming up with different rules based on the comfort level and hopefully based on the virus load, the viral numbers in their jurisdictions, in their areas. So I think a lot of that may be another avenue we see where there's an optional mandate, or there's the ability to let schools decide in some way or other.
That may be good for the attorneys out there, because I could see a lot more lawsuits being brought at local levels, perhaps, you know, if some towns could agree to disagree over it, I guess.
I think you're right about that. But no one, you know, it's going to be hard to find a place where everybody agrees. Even if you've got the one student or the one parent who really wants a mask, or who really wants a mask mandate, or who really wants not to have a mask mandate, right, there's going to be some variety throughout, right? And I think you're right. People are going to continue to legislate on this issue.
And my thanks to Margaret Etienne, Associate Dean and Professor of Law at the University of Illinois. Coming up, our reporter roundtable. You're listening to Connected to Chicago on 890 WLS.
This is Connected to Chicago. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.
Time for the reporter roundtable, where we welcome in Lynn Sweet, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business, and Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune. Well, folks, Governor Pritzker announced the end date for the mask mandate. Looks like it's going to happen by the end of the month, although some schools are still masked, and there is still an appeal out there over that judge's ruling downstate. Greg, do we think that will go away? Is getting rid of this mask mandate going to help with the governor's reelection?
Well, this is kind of an interesting mix of politics and health science. The scientific data shows that all the COVID statistics are going in the positive direction in a rush the last 3 or 4 weeks. Just to give one, the number of people being admitted to hospitals is less than a third of what it was a month ago. That's really good news. But the figures are still higher than they were before we went into the Omicron variant. And some people think we ought to take a little more time to open the doors freely. But political pressures being what they were, and and governors of other blue states like California and New York moving to lift their mask mandates. And this judge overruling Pritzker on the school mandate, it would have been politically awkward for him to do nothing. So what he decided to do was lift, assuming the numbers continue to get better, lift all the mask mandates by February 28th, except for schools. He says they're special. They need a little more time.
Lynn, there are other governors that are doing this, right? We're starting to see some other states go along with this. Is that right?
Right, but it doesn't impact on Illinois politics, where I don't think the voters care one bit what a governor and what Governor Newsom might be doing in California, what the New York governor is. But let me just quickly tick off why this was politically a no-brainer for Pritzker. One, there's no downside. Two, the anti-maskers are out there growing as a potent political force, and we will see that manifest itself in the Republican primary. And three, it may possibly make things a little better by not giving more issues to the anti-mask movement.
Well, I guess it's kind of wait and see now. So speaking of, the Republicans out there, Darren Bailey is coming out and saying he's not necessarily anti-vax, but he doesn't think that the vaccine works. I think he kind of shot himself in the foot over this. Lynn, want to weigh in either way?
Yeah, well, let me just so our listeners know, Darren Bailey is probably the most of the, five people running for governor on the Republican primary. He is the one who is the most strongly allied with former President Donald Trump. And whatever signals he was trying to say, he clearly is in no position to be the one that people turn to say if vaccines work or not. So when you put that out there as a question, it really it's a signal to your supporters what you really kind of mean, that he's trying to provide some cover for people who do not want to be vaccinated. Now, is this the correct way for him to make the play? I'm not sure, but he is in a very strong position, because in a multi-person primary where you only need a plurality to get the nomination in June, he probably is the one who can consolidate the Trump base. And that would include the anti-maskers, the anti-vaxxers, the election denialists, and the conspiracy theorists.
Nick, there's a little bit of difference among the Republican candidates, but frankly, everybody on the Republican side now is because of the appeal of the anti-vaxxers and the anti-mask folks and the kind of willing sense that we have to rally around the Trump base around this. They're all pretty much saying the same thing to one degree or another. A.D. Quigg from Queen and I had an interview with Gary Rabin, one of the other candidates today, and he made a point of saying that even though a lot of his relatives are vaccinated, he hasn't been. He says he opposes any kind of mandate. He went a little bit further, and it seemed to suggest that he'd oppose mandatory vaccination for measles and rubella and tuberculosis and stuff like that. You know, it's all. This concept that it's my freedom. I can do whatever I want. I don't owe anybody anything. If you don't like it, go and hide in a hole has really taken off in Republican
politics.
Right,
so I have a question.
Still a minority viewpoint. It motivates people, and it fires up the people who tend to turn out to vote.
Okay, so I have a question for everybody. Let me start with Greg. What candidate in the Republican primary right now can claim the Trump base? Who starts in the strongest position to do that?
Oh, I think I don't disagree with you that that Bailey philosophically and temperamentally has been associated with the Trump base more. But that doesn't mean that the other candidates aren't going to try to make a run for that Trump base, too. I mean, you could argue, for instance, that Richard Urban's a heavy concentration on crime is a wedge issue designed to get Republicans over, even if they don't think he's as pro-Trump as them. That's an issue he can cotton up to him on. I think they're all going for the base. I wouldn't disagree that Bailey is probably in the single strongest position.
Well, let's talk about the race to replace Bobby Rush. Lynn, it just keeps expanding, the number of people throwing their hat in the ring, huh?
Well, so far there are 15 people who filed statement to the candidacy with the Federal Election Commission. Now, and this is true for all the people running in the state of Illinois, you have until 5 p.m. on March, is it 4 or 14, to turn in your petitions. And then after that, people can withdraw. We won't know, probably there might be challenges to petitions. If you even have an idea that you may want to run for office, though, you have to be out there with your petitions now. So I don't know if the field will be that big. You have what I think is the top tier right now, and that is Alderman Pat Dowell, and that's because she had been running for Secretary of State, and once Bobby Rush surprised us all in January by saying he wasn't going to run again, she easily converted her campaign to a congressional race, which I think she's better suited for because of the issues involved in a congressional race as opposed to a Secretary of State race. Then you have Karen Normington Reeves, who I think no one knows. She runs a Cook County City Economic Jobs program, but she has the endorsement of Congressman Bobby Rush. And then there's Jonathan Jackson, the son of Reverend Jackson, who's in. I think because those connections, those three are the top tier. But others are out there. And again, in a plurality win, do the top three just cancel out the same vote and create a path for other people? Could be.
Yeah, I'd add one other name to the top tier. Jonathan Swain, the business guy, comes out of Hyde Park. Yeah, raised a lot of money. But Lynn's analysis is absolutely right. This is a race where it's going to narrow down. We don't know whether we're going to end up with 8 or 9 or 4 or 12 candidates. But it looks like it's going to be a big field. And potentially 25-30% of the vote, anybody who can get that wins it. That ain't very much. And anybody who really says that could predict exactly how it's going to turn out, they don't know what they're talking about. We don't know. There's just too many variables right now.
I think you could get a nominee with 21-22% on it. So here, let me just put this out to be a little provocative. Right now, all 15 are based on the south side within a few miles of each other. This district goes pretty far west in Will County, and it goes down to Bourbonnais. Okay, if somebody could get that vote out and figure out a way to appeal to the groups down there, some who are interested in agriculture, non-white, different ethnic groups. If you think that the black vote in this majority black district is just going to be divided among multiple candidates, I think there is a potential if somebody can figure out how to create, how to brand themselves, message themselves as the one who could represent the entire district, not just part of the district. Because a lot of what we've heard so far, and I've written about this, is the historic nature of the first congressional district. It's the only congressional district in the nation that has had a steady stream of representation by elected black congressmen in the nation. Oscar DePriest, who is in the 20th century, served in 1929, and since then, that's been the legacy. But when you're going to areas outside of the south side of Chicago, and this district doesn't even include the whole south side, some of the south side is represented by Robin Kelly, maybe that's not, you have to have another message, messages that resonate. And I think people do it all the time. You just can't be one thing. You can't, and I think Karen Norrington Reeves talked about this a lot at her announcement. Jonathan noted it. There's an issue that I think Swain and Jackson have talked about black migration out of the city, but you can only go so far of it because if those voters went to the southern suburbs in the district, you know, what's the problem? They're happy. They want to live where they, people want to live where they want to live. And so there's a lot of political calculus to deal with in this primary.
Yeah, I think Lynn puts her finger on something that's worth watching. While this district has elected a black congressman forever, and while everybody in this field is black, the fact of the matter is that on a raw population basis, it's just barely black. It's like 51%.
which means that somebody who can claim some legitimate credits in the African American community, but also pull over whites to support them, stands a real chance here. That's true in the suburbs. It's also true in the city. The whole 19th Ward is, I believe, is pretty much in this district. So some of the stuff that's going to go on quietly behind the scenes here to try to spread the base and put together coalitions, particularly with lots of people fighting over the conventional black base, could make it kind of interesting.
Yeah, there's also be a test of the clout of Reverend Jackson and Congressman Rush, who's also a minister, in terms of if they can deliver. You know, each of them, I think, sees this as a way of solidifying their legacy because they want to, in a sense, have a hand in picking the next congressman. And in terms of who has the most sway, who could bring in votes, who has an operation that actually registers people and then does GOTV, for the moment, I would give Reverend Jackson that because Jonathan is going to use PUSH as a, the Rainbow PUSH operation as some kind of a, he will somehow use his connection to that in a way you have to be careful because of federal election laws, but he has so many connections and stuff from there to be able to mobilize. It's not clear that Rush has an organization. I don't see any vast organization that Bobby Rush has. And he has himself done anemic fundraising. He's on major committees in the House, and his cash on hand balance as of December 31st was just like 190-something thousand, which is kind of nothing. So it's not even clear to me how he could be a significant help in fundraising. The national connections that Reverend Jackson has and Jonathan has are pretty strong. And I wouldn't be surprised if in the beginning, so Jonathan Swain said, I raised $200,000. And, they say in federal elections that the first $100,000, the second $100,000, to get to $200,000 is kind of easy. You call your friends, business acquaintances, relatives. It's getting out to people who are not within your known circle. That's what's tough. And I think that Jonathan Jackson just has a bigger circle to start with.
That and the fact that most people in that district don't know any of these people for the most part. The one name they probably do know is Jackson. That's why the first thing any candidate has to do is build name recognition. They have to let people know who they are. So if there is a single early favorite here, with all respect to Alderman Dowell and some of the other candidates, I think it's probably Mr. Jackson. His name is just much better known throughout the district than merely in a corner of it.
You have a good point. What do you think will be the impact of the downfall of his brother, former Congressman Jesse Jackson, who went to prison for looting his campaign fund, along with his then-wife, Sandy, who was a Chicago alderman? Will people think that the family gets another bite at the apple?
They might. That's certainly something to keep an eye on. I'd also keep an eye on where Mayor Lightfoot is going to go on this one. She could have some influence here. She so far is hanging back, but if she were to weigh in heavily on one side or another, it might make a difference.
Well, she told me when I talked to her when she was in Washington a few weeks ago that she did intend to endorse. And that is a big, big decision for her because she doesn't want to pick a loser, and she probably wants to pick somebody that could help her win the election if she decides to win.
Yep.
To run.
Well, there's also the backlash here, the potential backlash of if you don't support the Jacksons, do you risk having a blowback from that in future campaigns such as the mayor's? So there's all kinds of angles here to figure into this.
Yeah, when Lightfoot told me she was endorsing, Jonathan Jackson was not in the race.
Lynn, if you were to put those campaign dollars aside and put aside just for a minute the fact that Bobby Rush doesn't have the big bankroll, but Bobby Rush has a legacy background, if you will, that has to count for something, right?
Maybe yes, maybe no, in terms of his, but you can't put aside the things you say to put aside. He has a place in history. No one denies that. Everybody, every candidate will invoke Bobby Rush. So you might not even realize Jonathan Jackson already has a hoodie and T-shirts that has that have printed, I think, Washington for Harold Washington, and then Hayes for Charlie Hayes, Rush for Bobby Rush, and then Jackson. See, anybody can claim that they're the heir apparent here. So, but money, campaign money raised under the strict federal rules is something you can't just sweep aside here.
Okay. Ray Long, Chicago Tribune, you had a story, sir, and your colleagues as well, talking about, I guess, Mayor Lori Lightfoot not really letting the light in, as she promised.
Yeah, that's really true. We filed a lawsuit with a couple of instances where we've basically been stonewalled by the city, despite a couple of attorney general opinions that actually said, you know, give it to the Tribune, give the records that we wanted from the Tribune. And the city said, well, you know, it's an advisory opinion, so no. And so we've taken these to court, and the, you know, with the attorney general's backing already, it's a pretty good case. So we've got that. And then why do we care about these things? Well, we had a big story today in the, or rather Friday in the Chicago Tribune about some of Lori Lightfoot's emails where she was taking Kwame Raoul, the attorney general, to task for the idea that his one of his attorneys in court was saying, hey, the city's not moving fast enough for fast enough on police reform. And that really torqued Lori Lightfoot off. And she was complaining that to Raoul in a text, this is a text message now, your person didn't say it was slow. She mocked my announcement from earlier this week, called me out by name and said the city is intentionally foot dragging. So she really tried to light up Raoul, who basically said that, well, you know, I'll communicate as well if you communicate that to the press. And she contended it was a cheap political shot, and he wrote back that it wasn't. So we see what is actually going on in some of these behind the closed door discussions, in this case, behind the closed text discussions. And that's why we're trying to pry open emails too. And that's what reporters do. We just fight for the light. And she said she wanted to bring in the light, so we're trying to help her bring it.
And a real question here is how the typical Chicagoans respond to this. So we've had temperamental mayors in this town before. Rich Daley had a huge temper. Rahm Emanuel was almost infamous for his use of profanity. But Lori Lightfoot has a particularly direct way of getting in your face and telling you exactly what she thinks of you, and this story illustrated some of that. The question is, whether does that come across as bad form, or does it come across as ingratiating, or maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, it's really a good question.
My question is, what does it take? Why do people write these things down when they know that all these communications may likely come to light because of public information laws?
It right. Just,
yeah. For the like, same reason that Chicago aldermen stick their hands out, because they can't.
Well, right, but I see this time and again, and I don't understand why people... I mean, this is not an original play to ask for the mayor's communications.
Right, it is, right.
It is expected. I would have been surprised if no one did in her years in office. So what kind of advice is she getting? What kind of common political sense does she have to just say, call me, and put it in capital letters so he knows that she's irritated at him?
Right. You know, this is kind of the playbook of Michael Madigan, the longtime House Speaker, where he didn't put much down in writing, and many other politicians who he counseled don't put it in writing, and you don't have to answer for it later. But I'm glad they are, because we're getting an inside peek about how things are really coming off with our public officials here, how they really feel about things.
We're going to have to leave it there. And my thanks to Lynn Sweet, Washington, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Chicago Sun-Times, Greg Hines of Crane Chicago Business, and Ray Long of the Chicago Tribune. Up next, Kim Gordon. You're listening to Connected to Chicago on WLS.
This is Connected to Chicago, a look at the top stories of the week with the people making, covering, and talking about the news of the day. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.
A new University of Illinois study finds disturbingly high levels of lead in soil samples across Chicago. Joining me today is Professor Andrew Margonaut at the University of Illinois in the Crop Sciences Department to discuss the study. Professor, welcome to Connected to Chicago.
Thank you for having me.
So we hear about the connection to lead levels in pipes, but it's also, as you found, in soil, and apparently soil where children play can be just as dangerous as those old pipes. So tell us about the study, what you found, and why you decided to do it in the first place.
Sure thing. I can start with why we decided to do this work. And long story short, we know that there's a lead risk issue in Chicago. There's lots of data on blood lead of children by census tract. And it suggests that even though we have achieved marked reductions in how much lead is in kids' blood, there's still amounts, especially in West and South Side, that are problematic. So soils are one of the main sources. As you've rightfully pointed out, water from leaded pipes is another one. So we wanted to, as a first step, assess across Chicago how much lead is there and where is it. We took a bird's eye view, and so we sampled roughly 2,000 locations across the city every 600 yards or so on a grid pattern. So we have full city coverage, and then we looked at the amount of total lead in the soil. And what we found overall was that there's 11 times higher lead than what should naturally be there. Now, soils naturally have some amounts. The value is called 20 part per million. We found an average of 220 to 240 part per million. So that's about 10 to 11 times higher than normal.
What neighborhoods had the highest lead levels, and do you know why?
The average across the city is about 10, 11 times higher than what is natural. Now, an important detail here is what constitutes a threat is a different question, and it's kind of under debate. Different agencies, federal to state, don't agree on how much lead in the soil is too much lead. So if you look at what the federal and the Illinois EPA recommend, their threshold is 400 ppm. Again, we're at around 220 on average across Chicago. But some state EPAs like Minnesota or California put it at lower, 80 or 100 ppm respectively. So if you go by the more conservative California EPA threshold, we found that 93% of the city, no matter where you are, that 93% of the city is going to exceed that threshold. But if you go by the federal and the Illinois EPA threshold of 400 ppm, then most of the city is actually below that threshold. There are some hot spots, and in general, as you go away from the loop in a concentric circle, the amount of lead falls off. And we found hot spots that are largely directly to the west of the loop, so thinking around Pilsner area, and then the southeast shore region also had a hot spot. And those were in excess of the Illinois and the federal EPA threshold. So we're talking above 400 ppm, that is more than 20 times higher than natural.
Great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I know this is really important information, especially for parents and people with young children in their lives. So we really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me. And that's why we did this work, is to give parents the first step of how to assess risk for their children.
Great. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that'll do it for this week's Connected to Chicago. My thanks to reporters Ray Long of the Tribune, Greg Hines of Cranes, and Heather Sharon of WTTW. Also, thanks to Matt Mellon for his technical assistance. I'm Nick Gale, 890 WLS News.
Connected to Chicago, a production of WLS News. Podcasts are available online at WLSAM.com.